If you ask the original Saturday Night Live team why the show was such a success, they'll talk about Lorne Michaels. There's something about his leadership, they'll say, that made everything come together. He had an ability to make everyone feel heard, to make even the most self-centered actors and writers pay attention to each other. His eye for talent is nearly unrivaled in entertainment over the last 40 years. You'll also find people who say that Michaels is aloof, socially awkward, proud, and jealous, and that when he decides to fire someone, he'll cut them completely adrift. You might not want Michaels as a friend, but as the leader of Saturday Night Live, what he's created is extraordinary. One of the longest-running shows in history, built on the talent of egomaniacal comedians who, 20 times a year for 4 decades, have put their craziness aside just long enough to make a live television program with only a week's preparation. Michaels himself, still the show's executive producer, says the reason why Saturday Night Live has succeeded is because he works hard to force people to become a team. The secret to making that happen, he says, is giving everyone a voice and finding people willing to be sensitive enough to listen to one another. Lorne was deliberate about making sure everyone got a chance to pitch their ideas, the writer Marilyn Miller told me. He would say, "Do we have pieces for the girls this week? Who hasn't been on in a while?" He has this kind of psychic ability to draw in everyone, said Alan Zweibel. I honestly believe that's why the show has existed for 40 years. At the top of each script, there's a list of the initials of everyone who worked on that sketch, and Lorne has always said he's happiest the more initials he sees. Michaels is almost ostentatious in his demonstrations of social sensitivity, and he expects the cast and writers to mimic him. During the early years of the show, he was the one who appeared with a soothing word when an exhausted writer was crying in his office. He has been known to interrupt a rehearsal or table read and quietly take an actor aside to ask if they need to talk about something going on in their personal life. Once, when the writer Michael O'Donohue was inordinately proud of an obscene commercial parody, Michaels ordered it read at 18 different rehearsals, even though everyone knew the network censors would never let it on the air. I remember walking up to Lorne once and saying, "Okay, here's my idea. It's a bunch of girls at their first slumber party, and they're telling each other how sex works." And Lorne said, "Write it up, just like that. No questions asked." Then he took an index card and put it on the board for the next show. That sketch, which appeared on Saturday Night Live on May 8, 1976, became one of the show's most famous pieces. "I was on top of the world," said Miller. "He's got this social ESP. Sometimes he knows exactly what will make you feel like the most important person on earth." Many of the original actors and writers on Saturday Night Live weren't particularly easy to get along with. They freely admit that, even today, they are combative and gossipy and sometimes downright mean. But when they worked together, they were careful with one another's feelings. Michael O'Donohue might have dropped Garrett Morris's script into a trash can, but he made a point afterward to tell Morris he was joking. And when Morris suggested an idea about a depressing children's story, O'Donohue came up with "The Little Train That Died." "I know I can, I know I can. Heart attack, heart attack. Oh my God, the pain." The SNL team avoided picking fights with one another. "When I made that Hitler joke, Marilyn wouldn't speak to me," Beats told me. "But that's the point. She didn't speak. She didn't escalate it into a whole big thing." People might have criticized one another's ideas, but they were careful about how far they let their critiques go. They disagreed and clashed, but everyone still had a voice at each table read, and despite the sniping and competition, they were oddly protective of one another. Everyone liked everyone else, or at least worked hard to pretend like they liked everyone, said Don Novello, a writer on the show in the 1970s and 80s, and the actor who played Father Guido Sarducci. We genuinely trusted each other, as crazy as that sounds. For psychological safety to emerge among a group, teammates don't have to be friends. They do, however, need to be socially sensitive and ensure everyone feels heard. The best tactic for establishing psychological safety is demonstration by a team leader, as Amy Edmondson, who is now a professor at Harvard Business School, told me. It seems like fairly minor stuff, but when the leader goes out of their way to make someone feel listened to, or starts a meeting by saying, "I might miss something, so I need all of you to watch for my mistakes," or says, "Jim, you haven't spoken in a while. What do you think?" That makes a huge difference. In Edmondson's hospital studies, the teams with the highest levels of psychological safety were also the ones with leaders most likely to model listening and social sensitivity. They invited people to speak up. They talked about their own emotions. They didn't interrupt other people. When someone was concerned or upset, they showed the group that it was okay to intervene. They tried to anticipate how people would react and then worked to accommodate those reactions. This is how teams encourage people to disagree while still being honest with one another and occasionally clashing. This is how psychological safety emerges. By giving everyone an equal voice and encouraging social sensitivity among teammates. Michaels himself says the job of modeling norms is his most important duty. Everyone who comes through this show is different, and I have to show each of them that I'm treating them different, and show everyone else I'm treating them different, if we want to draw the unique brilliance out of everyone, Michaels told me. SNL only works when we have different writing and performing styles all bumping into and meshing with each other, he said. That's my job, to protect people's distinct voices, but also to get them to work together. I want to preserve whatever made each person special before they came to the show, but also help everyone be sensitive enough to make the rough edges fit. That's the only way we can do a new show every week without everyone wanting to kill each other as soon as we're done. 4. By the summer of 2015, the Google researchers working on Project Aristotle had been collecting surveys, conducting interviews, running regressions, and analyzing statistics for 2 years. They had scrutinized tens of thousands of pieces of data and had written dozens of software programs to analyze trends. Finally, they were ready to reveal their conclusions to the company's employees. They scheduled a meeting at the headquarters in Mountain View. Thousands of employees showed up, and many more watched via video stream. Laszlo Bock, the head of the People Operations Department at Google, walked onto the stage and thanked everyone for coming. The biggest thing you should take away from this work is that how teams work matters, in a lot of ways, more than who is on them, he said. He had spoken to me before he went on stage. There's a myth we all carry inside our head, Bock said. We think we need superstars, but that's not what our research found. You can take a team of average performers, and if you teach them to interact the right way, they'll do things no superstar could ever accomplish. And there's other myths, like sales teams should be run differently than engineering teams, or the best teams need to achieve consensus around everything, or high-performing teams need a high volume of work to stay engaged, or teams need to be physically located together. But now we can say those aren't right. The data shows there's a universality to how good teams succeed. It's important that everyone on a team feels like they have a voice, but whether they actually get to vote on things or make decisions turns out not to matter much. Neither does the volume of work or physical co-location. What matters is having a voice and social sensitivity. On stage, Bock brought up a series of slides. What matters are 5 key norms, he told the audience. Teams need to believe that their work is important. Teams need to feel their work is personally meaningful. Teams need clear goals and defined roles. Team members need to know they can depend on one another. But most important, teams need psychological safety. To create psychological safety, Bach said, team leaders needed to model the right behaviors. There were Google-designed checklists they could use. Leaders should not interrupt teammates during conversations, because that will establish an interrupting norm. They should demonstrate they are listening by summarizing what people say after they said it. They should admit what they don't know. They shouldn't end a meeting until all team members have spoken at least once. They should encourage people who are upset to express their frustrations and encourage teammates to respond in non-judgmental ways. They should call out intergroup conflicts and resolve them through open discussion. There were dozens of tactics on the checklist. All of them, however, came back to two general principles. Teams succeed when everyone feels like they can speak up and when members show they are sensitive to how one another feels. There are lots of small things a leader can do, Abir Dubey told me. In meetings, does the leader cut people off by saying, "Let me ask a question there," or does she wait until someone is done speaking? How does the leader act when someone's upset? These things are so subtle, but they can have a huge impact. Every team is different, and it's not uncommon in a company like Google for engineers or salespeople to be taught to fight for what they believe in. But you need the right norms to make arguments productive rather than destructive. Otherwise, a team never becomes stronger. For 3 months, Project Aristotle traveled from division to division, explaining their findings and coaching team leaders. Google's top executives released tools that any team could use to evaluate if members felt psychologically safe, and worksheets to help leaders and teammates improve their scores. I come from a quantitative background. If I'm going to believe something, you need to give me data to back it up, said Sognik Nandi, who as chief of Google Analytics Engineering heads one of the company's biggest teams. So seeing this data has been a game changer for me. Engineers love debugging software because we know we can get 10% more efficiency by just making a few tweaks. But we never focus on debugging human interactions. We put great people together and hope it will work. And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. And most of the time, we don't know why. Aristotle let us debug our people. It's totally changed how I run meetings. I'm so much more conscious of how I model listening now, or whether I interrupt, or how I encourage everyone to speak. The project has had an impact on the Aristotle team as well. A couple of months ago, we were in a meeting where I made a mistake, Julia Rozovsky told me. Not a huge mistake, but an embarrassing one. And afterward, I sent out a note explaining what had gone wrong, why it had happened, and what we were doing to resolve it. Right afterward, I got an email back from a team member that just said, "Ouch." It was like a punch to the gut. I was already upset about making this mistake, and this note totally played on my insecurities. But because of all the work we've done, I pinged the person back and said, "Nothing like a good ouch to destroy psychological safety in the morning." And he wrote back and said, "I'm just testing your resilience." That could have been the wrong thing to say to someone else, but he knew it was exactly what I needed to hear. With one 30-second interaction, we diffused the tension. It's funny to do a project on team effectiveness while working on a team, because we get to test everything we're learning as we go along. What I've realized is that as long as everyone feels like they can talk, and we're really demonstrating that we want to hear each other, you feel like everyone's got your back. Over the last two decades, the American workplace has become much more team-focused. The average worker today might belong to a sales team, as well as a group of unit managers, a special team planning future projects, and the team overseeing the holiday party. Executives belong to groups that oversee compensation and strategy, and hiring and firing, and approving HR policies, and figuring out how to cut costs. These teams might meet every day in person, or correspond via email, or telecommute from all over the world. Teams are important. Within companies and conglomerates, government agencies and schools, teams are now the fundamental unit of self-organization. And the unwritten rules that make teams succeed or fail, it turns out, are the same from place to place. The way investment bankers coordinate their efforts might seem different from how orthopedic nurses divvy up tasks. And the specific norms in those different settings will likely vary. But one thing will remain true if those teams work well. In both places, the groups will feel a sense of psychological safety. They will succeed because teammates feel they can trust each other, and that honest discussion can occur without fear of retribution. Their members will have roughly equal voices. Teammates will show they are sensitive to one another's emotions and needs. In general, the route to establishing psychological safety begins with the team's leader. So if you are leading a team, be it a group of coworkers or a sports team, a church gathering, or your family dinner table, think about what message your choices send. Are you encouraging equality in speaking or rewarding the loudest people? Are you modeling listening? Are you demonstrating a sensitivity to what people think and feel? Or are you letting decisive leadership be an excuse for not paying as close attention as you should? There are always good reasons for choosing behaviors that undermine psychological safety. It is often more efficient to cut off debate, to make a quick decision, to listen to whoever knows the most, and ask others to hold their tongues. But a team will become an amplification of its internal culture, for better or worse. Study after study shows that while psychological safety might be less efficient in the short run, it's more productive over time. If motivation comes from giving individuals a greater sense of control, then psychological safety is the caveat we must remember when individuals come together in a group. Establishing control requires more than just seizing self-determination. Being a subversive works, unless you're leading a team. When people come together in a group, sometimes we need to give control to others. That's ultimately what team norms are. Individuals willingly giving a measure of control to their teammates. But that works only when people feel like they can trust one another. It only succeeds when we feel psychologically safe. As a team leader, then, it's important to give people control. Some team leaders at Google make check marks next to people's names each time they speak, and won't end a meeting until those checks are all roughly equivalent. And as a team member, we share control by demonstrating that we are genuinely listening, by repeating what someone just said, by responding to their comments, by showing we care by reacting when someone seems upset or flustered, rather than acting as if nothing is wrong. When we defer to others' judgment, when we vocally treat others' concerns as our own, we give control to the group, and psychological safety takes hold. The thing I love most is when I see a sketch performed and the actors are really killing it on stage, and the sketch's writers are high-fiving each other by the monitor, and whoever is waiting in the wings is laughing, and there's another team already figuring out how to make the characters funnier next time, Lorne Michaels told me. When I see the entire team drawing some kind of inspiration from the same thing, I know everything is working, he said. At that moment, the whole team is rooting for each other, and each person feels like the star. Chapter 3. Focus. Cognitive Tunneling, Air France Flight 447, and the Power of Mental Models. When they finally found the wreckage, it was clear that few of the victims had realized disaster was near, even as it struck. There was no evidence of passengers' last-minute buckling of seatbelts or frenzied raising of food trays. Oxygen masks were firmly encased in ceiling panels. A submarine probing the wreckage at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean found a whole row of seats upright in the sand, as if waiting to fly again. It had taken almost 2 years to find the plane's data recorders, and everyone hoped that once they were retrieved, the cause of the accident would become clear at last. Initially, however, the recorders offered few clues. None of the plane's computers had malfunctioned, according to the data. There was no indication of mechanical failure or electrical glitch. It wasn't until investigators listened to the cockpit voice recordings that they began to understand. This Airbus, one of the largest and most sophisticated aircraft ever built, a plane designed to be an error-proof model of automation, was at the bottom of the ocean not because of a defect in machinery, but because of a failure of attention. 23 months earlier, on May 31, 2009, the night sky was clear as Air France Flight 447 pulled away from the gate in Rio de Janeiro with 228 people on board, bound for Paris. In the cabin were honeymooners and a former conductor for the Washington National Opera, a well-known arms control activist, and an 11-year-old boy headed to boarding school. One of the plane's pilots had brought his wife to Rio so they could enjoy a 3-day layover at the Copacabana beach. Now she was in the back of the massive aircraft, while he and two colleagues were in the cockpit flying them home. As the plane began its ascent, there were a few radioed exchanges with air traffic control, the standard chatter that accompanies any takeoff. 4 minutes after lifting from the runway, the pilot in the right seat, the junior position, activated the autopilot. For the next 10.5 hours, if all went according to plan, the plane would essentially fly itself. Just 2 decades earlier, flying from Rio to Paris had been a much more taxing affair. Prior to the 1990s and advances in cockpit automation, pilots were responsible for calculating dozens of variables during a flight, including airspeed, fuel consumption, direction, and optimal cruising altitude, all while monitoring weather disturbances, discussions with air traffic control, and the plane's position in the sky. Such trips were so demanding that pilots often rotated responsibilities. They all knew the risks if vigilance waned. In 1987, a pilot in Detroit had become so overwhelmed during takeoff that he had forgotten to set the wing flaps. 154 people died when the plane crashed after takeoff. 15 years before that, pilots flying near Miami had become fixated on a faulty landing gear light and had failed to notice that they were gradually descending. 101 people were killed when the craft slammed into the Everglades. Before automated aviation systems were invented, it wasn't unheard of for more than 1,000 people to die each year in airplane accidents, often because pilots' attention spans were stretched too thin or due to other human errors. The plane flying from Rio to Paris, however, had been designed to eliminate such mistakes by vastly reducing the number of decisions a pilot had to make. The Airbus A330 was so advanced that its computers could automatically intervene when problems arose, identify solutions, and then tell pilots, via on-screen instructions, where to direct their focus as they responded to computerized prompts. In optimal conditions, a human might fly for only about 8 minutes per trip during takeoff and landing. Planes like the A330 had fundamentally changed piloting from a proactive to a reactive profession. As a result, flying was easier. Accident rates went down, and airlines' productivity soared because more customers could travel with less crew. A transoceanic flight had once required as many as 6 pilots. By the time of Flight 447, thanks to automation, Air France needed only 2 people in the cockpit at any given time. 4 hours into the trip, midway between Brazil and Senegal, the plane crossed the equator. Most of the passengers would have been asleep. There were clouds from a tropical storm in the distance. The 2 men in the cockpit remarked on static electricity dancing across the windows, a phenomenon known as St. Elmo's fire. "I'm dimming the lighting a bit to see outside, eh?" said Pierre-Cédric Bonin, the pilot whose wife was in the passenger cabin. "Yes, yes," the captain replied. There was a 3rd aviator in a small hold behind the cockpit taking a nap. The captain summoned the 3rd man to switch places, and then left the 2 junior pilots at the control so he could sleep. The plane was flying smoothly on full autopilot at 32,000 feet. 20 minutes later, there was a small bump from turbulence. "It might be a good idea to tell the passengers to buckle up," Bonin informed a stewardess over the intercom. As the air surrounding the cockpit cooled, 3 metal cylinders jutting from the craft's body, the pitot tubes, which measure airspeed by detecting the force of air flowing into them, became clogged with ice crystals. For almost 100 years, aviators have complained about, and safely accommodated, ice and pitot tubes. Most pilots know that if their airspeed measurement plunges unexpectedly, it's likely because of clogged pitot tubes. When the pitot tubes on Flight 447 froze over, the plane's computers lost airspeed information, and the autoflight system turned off, as it was programmed to do. A warning alarm sounded. "I have the controls," Bonin said calmly. "Okay," his colleague replied. At this point, if the aviators had done nothing at all, the plane would have continued flying safely, and the pitot tubes would have eventually thawed. But Bonin, perhaps shaken out of a reverie by the alarm and wanting to offset the loss of the autopilot, pulled back a bit on the command stick, causing the plane's nose to nudge upward and the aircraft to gain altitude. Within 1 minute, it had ascended by 3,000 feet. With Flight 447's nose now pointed slightly upward, the plane's aerodynamics began to change. The atmosphere at that height was thin, and the ascent had disrupted the smooth flow of air over the plane's wings. The craft's lift, the basic force of physics that pulls airplanes into the sky because there is less pressure above a wing than below it, began deteriorating. In extreme conditions, this can cause an aerodynamic stall, a dangerous situation in which a plane starts falling even as its engines strain with thrust and the nose points skyward. A stall is easy to overcome in its early stages. Simply lowering the nose so air begins flowing smoothly over the wings prevents a stall from emerging. But if a plane's nose remains upward, a stall will become worse and worse until the airplane drops like a stone in a well. As Flight 447 rose through the thin atmosphere, a loud chime erupted in the cockpit and a recorded voice began warning, "Stall, stall, stall, stall," indicating that the plane's nose was pointed too high. "What's this?" the co-pilot said. "There's no good speed indication," Bonin responded. The pitot tubes were still clogged with ice, and so the display did not show any airspeed. "Pay attention to your speed," the co-pilot said. "Okay, okay, I'm descending," Bonin replied. "It says we're going up," the co-pilot said. "So descend." "Okay," said Bonin. But Bonin didn't descend. If he had leveled the plane, the craft would have flown on safely. Instead, he continued pulling back on the stick slightly, pushing the airplane's nose further into the sky. Automation has today penetrated nearly every aspect of our lives. Most of us now drive cars equipped with computers that automatically engage the brakes and reduce transmission power when we hit a patch of rain or ice, often so subtly we never notice the vehicle has anticipated our tendency to overcorrect. We work in offices where customers are routed to departments via computerized phone systems. Emails are automatically sent when we're away from our desks, and bank accounts are instantaneously hedged against currency fluctuations. We communicate with smartphones that finish our words. Even without technology's help, all humans rely on cognitive automations, known as heuristics, that allow us to multitask. That's why we can email the babysitter while chatting with our spouse and simultaneously watching the kids. Mental automation lets us choose, almost subconsciously, what to pay attention to and what to ignore. Automations have made factories safer, offices more efficient, cars less accident-prone, and economies more stable. By one measure, there have been more gains in personal and professional productivity in the past 50 years than in the previous two centuries combined, much of it made possible by automation. But as automation becomes more common, the risks that our attention spans will fail have risen. Studies from Yale, UCLA, Harvard, Berkeley, NASA, the National Institutes of Health, and elsewhere show errors are particularly likely when people are forced to toggle between automaticity and focus, and are unusually dangerous as automatic systems infiltrate airplanes, cars, and other environments where a misstep can be tragic. In the age of automation, knowing how to manage your focus is more critical than ever before. Take, for instance, Bonin's mindset when he was forced to take control of Flight 447. It is unclear why he continued guiding the plane upward after agreeing with his co-pilot that they should descend. Maybe he hoped to climb above the storm clouds on the horizon. Perhaps it was an unintentional reaction to the sudden alarm. We will never know why he didn't return the controls to neutral once the stall warning sounded. There is significant evidence, however, that Bonin was in the grip of what's known as cognitive tunneling, a mental glitch that sometimes occurs when our brains are forced to transition abruptly from relaxed automation to panicked attention. You can think about your brain's attention span like a spotlight that can go wide and diffused or tight and focused, said David Strayer, a cognitive psychologist at the University of Utah. Our attention span is guided by our intentions. We choose, in most situations, whether to focus the spotlight or let it be relaxed. But when we allow automated systems, such as computers or autopilots, to pay attention for us, our brains dim that spotlight and allow it to swing wherever it wants. This is, in part, an effort by our brains to conserve energy. The ability to relax in this manner gives us huge advantages. It helps us subconsciously control stress levels and makes it easier to brainstorm. It means we don't have to constantly monitor our environment, and it helps us get ready for big cognitive tasks. Our brains automatically seek out opportunities to disconnect and unwind. But then, bam, some kind of emergency happens, or you get an unexpected email, or someone asks you an important question in a meeting, and suddenly the spotlight in your head has to ramp up all of a sudden, and, at first, it doesn't know where to shine, said Strayer. So the brain's instinct is to force it as bright as possible on the most obvious stimuli, whatever's right in front of you, even if that's not the best choice. That's when cognitive tunneling happens. Cognitive tunneling can cause people to become overly focused on whatever is directly in front of their eyes or become preoccupied with immediate tasks. It's what keeps someone glued to their smartphone as the kids wail or pedestrians swerve around them on the sidewalk. It's what causes drivers to slam on their brakes when they see a red light ahead, We can learn techniques to get better at toggling between relaxation and concentration, but they require practice and a desire to remain engaged. However, once in a cognitive tunnel, we lose our ability to direct our focus. Instead, we latch onto the easiest and most obvious stimulus, often at the cost of common sense. As the pitot tubes iced over and the alarms blared, Bonin entered a cognitive tunnel. His attention had been relaxed for the past 4 hours. Now, amid flashing lights and ringing bells, his attention searched for a focal point. The most obvious one was the video monitor right in front of his eyes. The cockpit of an Airbus A330 is a minimalist masterpiece, an environment designed to be distraction-free, with just a few screens alongside a modest number of gauges and controls. One of the most prominent screens, directly in each pilot's line of sight, is the primary flight display. There is a broad line running across the horizontal center of a screen that indicates the division between sky and land. Floating atop this line is the small icon of an aircraft. If a plane rolls to either side while flying, the icon goes off kilter, and pilots know their wings are no longer parallel to the ground. When Bonin heard the alarm and looked at his instrument panel, he saw the primary flight display. The icon of the plane on that screen had rolled slightly to the right. Normally, this would not have been a concern. Planes roll in small increments throughout a trip and are easily righted. But now, with the autopilot disengaged and the sudden pressure to focus, the spotlight inside Bonin's head shined on that off-kilter icon. Bonin, data records indicate, became focused on getting the wings of that icon level with the middle of his screen. And then, perhaps because he was fixated on correcting the roll, he failed to notice that he was still pulling back on the control stick, lifting the plane's nose. As Bonin pulled back on his stick, the front of the aircraft rose higher. Then, another instance of cognitive tunneling occurred, this time inside the head of Bonin's co-pilot. The man in the left-hand seat was named David Robert, and he was officially the monitoring pilot. His job was to keep watch over Bonin and intervene if the flying pilot became overwhelmed. In a worst-case scenario, Robert could take control of the craft. But now, with alarm sounding, Robert did what's most natural in such a situation. He became focused on the most obvious stimuli. There was a screen next to him spewing text as the plane's computer provided updates and instructions. Robert turned his eyes away from Bonin and began staring at the scrolling type, reading the messages aloud. "Stabilize," Robert said. "Go back down." Focused on the screen as he was, Robert didn't see that Bonin was pulling back on his stick and didn't register that the flying pilot was raising the craft higher even as he agreed they needed to descend. There is no evidence that Robert looked at his gauges. Instead, he frantically scrolled through a series of messages automatically generated by the plane's computer. Even if those prompts had been helpful, nothing indicates that Bonin, locked on the airplane icon in front of him, heard anything his colleagues said. The plane rose through 35,000 feet, drawing dangerously close to its maximum height. The nose of the airplane was now pitched at 12 degrees. The co-pilot finally looked away from his screen. "We're climbing, according to this," he told Bonin, referring to the instrument panel. "Go back down," he shouted. "Okay," Bonin replied. Bonin pushed his stick forward, forcing the plane's nose to dip slightly. As a result, the force of gravity against the pilots lessened by a third, giving them a brief sense of weightlessness. "Gently," his colleague snapped. Then Bonin, perhaps overwhelmed by the combination of the alarms, the weightlessness, and his co-pilot's chastisement, jerked his hand backward, arresting the descent of the plane's nose. The craft remained at a 6-degree upward pitch. Another loud warning chime came from the cockpit's speakers, and a few seconds later, the aircraft began to shake, what's known as buffeting, the result of rough air moving across the wings in the early stages of a serious aerodynamic stall.
We're in a climb, I think, Bonas said.
For the next 10 seconds, neither man spoke. The plane rose above its maximum recommended altitude of 37,500 feet. To stay aloft, Flight 447 had to descend. If Bonin would simply lower the nose, all would be fine. Then, as the pilots focused on their screens, the ice crystals clogging the pitot tubes cleared, and the plane's computer began receiving accurate airspeed information once again. From this moment onward, all the craft's sensors functioned correctly throughout the flight. The computer began spitting out instructions, telling the pilots how to overcome the stall. Their instrument panels were showing them everything they needed to know to right the plane, but they had no idea where to look. Even as helpful information arrived, Bonin and Robert had no clue as to where to focus. The stall warning blared again. A piercing, high-pitched noise called the cricket, designed to be impossible for pilots to ignore, began to sound.
"Damn it!"
the co-pilot yelled. He had already paged the captain.
"Where is he? Above all, try to touch the lateral controls as little as possible," he told Bonin.
"Okay," Bonin replied. "I'm in toga, right?"
It is at this moment, investigators later concluded, that the lives of all 228 people on board Flight 447 were condemned. TOGA is an acronym for Takeoff Go-Around, a setting that aviators use to abort a landing or go around the runway. TOGA pushes a plane's thrust to maximum while the pilot raises the nose. There is a sequence of moves associated with TOGA that all aviators practice hundreds of times in preparation for a certain kind of emergency. At low altitudes, TOGA makes a lot of sense. The air is thick near the Earth's surface, and so increasing thrust and raising the nose makes a plane go faster and higher, allowing a pilot to abort a landing safely. But at 38,000 feet, the air is so thin that TOGA doesn't work. A plane can't draw additional thrust at that height, and raising the nose simply increases the severity of a stall. At that altitude, the only correct choice is lowering the nose. In his startled panic, however, Bonin made a second mistake, a mental misstep that is a cousin to cognitive tunneling. He sought to aim the spotlight in his head onto something familiar. Bonin fell back on a reaction he had practiced repeatedly, a sequence of moves he had learned to associate with emergencies. He fell into what psychologists call reactive thinking. Reactive thinking is at the core of how we allocate our attention, and in many settings, it's a tremendous asset. Athletes, for example, practice certain moves again and again, so that during a game, they can think reactively and execute plays faster than their opponents can respond. Reactive thinking is how we build habits, and it's why to-do lists and calendar alerts are so helpful. Rather than needing to decide what to do next, we can take advantage of our reactive instincts and automatically proceed. Reactive thinking, in a sense, outsources the choices and control that, in other settings, create motivation. But the downside of reactive thinking is that habits and reactions can become so automatic, they overpower our judgment. Once our motivation is outsourced, we simply react. One study conducted by Strayer, the psychologist, in 2009, looked at how drivers' behaviors changed when cars were equipped with features such as cruise control and automatic braking systems that allowed people to pay less attention to road conditions. These technologies are supposed to make driving safer, and many times they do, said Strayer. But it also makes reactive thinking easier. And so when the unexpected startles you, when the car skids or you have to brake suddenly, you'll react with practiced habitual responses, like stomping on the pedal or twisting the wheel too far. Instead of thinking, you react. And if it's not the correct response, bad things happen. Inside the cockpit, as the alarm sounded and the cricket chirped, the pilots were silent. Robert, the co-pilot, perhaps lost in his own thoughts, didn't reply to Bonin's question, "I'm in toga, right?" But instead tried once again to beckon the captain, who was still resting in the hold. If Bonin had paused to consider the basic facts, he was in thin air, a stall alarm was sounding, the plane couldn't safely go higher. He would have immediately realized he needed to lower the airplane's nose. Instead, he relied on behaviors he had practiced hundreds of times and pulled back on the stick. The plane's nose increased to a terrifying 18-degree pitch as Bonin pushed the throttle open. The plane moved higher, touched the top of an arc, and then started dropping, its nose still pointed upward and the engines at full thrust. The cockpit began shaking as the buffeting grew more pronounced. The plane was falling fast.
"What the hell is happening?" the co-pilot asked. "Do you understand what's happening or not?" "I don't have control of the plane anymore," Bonin shouted. "I don't have control of the plane at all."
In the cabin, passengers probably had little idea anything was wrong. There were no alarms they could hear. The buffeting likely felt like normal turbulence. Neither pilot ever made an announcement of any kind. The captain finally entered the cockpit.
"What the hell are you doing?" he asked. "I don't know what's happening," Robert said. "We're losing control of the airplane," Bonin shouted. "We lost control of the airplane and we don't understand at all," Robert said. "We've tried everything."
Flight 447 was now sinking at a rate of 10,000 feet per minute. The captain, standing behind the pilots and perhaps overwhelmed by what he saw, uttered a curse word and then remained silent for 41 seconds.
"I have a problem," Bonas said,
the panic audible in his voice.
"I have no more displays."
This was not correct. The displays, the screens on his instrument panel, were providing accurate information and were clearly visible. But Bonin was too overwhelmed to focus.
"I have the impression we're going crazily fast," Bonin said.
The plane, in fact, at this point was moving far too slowly.
"What do you think?"
Bonin asked as he reached for the lever that would raise the speed brakes on the wing, slowing the plane even more.
"No," shouted the co-pilot. "Above all, don't extend the brakes." "Okay," Bonas said. "What should we do?" the co-pilot asked the captain. "What do you see?"
"I don't know," the captain said. "It's descending."
Over the next 35 seconds, as the pilot shouted questions, the plane dropped another 9,000 feet.
"Am I going down now?"
Bonas asked. The instruments in front of him could have easily answered that question.
"You're going down, down, down," the co-pilot said. "I've been at full back stick for a while," Bonas said. "No, no," the captain shouted.
The plane was now less than 10,000 feet above the Atlantic Ocean.
"Don't climb." "Give me the controls," the co-pilot said. "The controls, to me." "Go ahead," Bonas says,
finally releasing the stick.
"You have the controls. We're still in toga, right?"
As the co-pilot took over, the plane fell another 6,000 feet closer to the sea.
"Watch out! You're pitching up there," the captain said. "I'm pitching up?"
the co-pilot replied.
"You're pitching up,"
the captain said.
"Well, we need to," Bonas said. "We're at 4,000 feet."
By now, The only way the craft could pick up enough speed was to lower its nose into a dive and let more air flow over the wings. But with such a small distance between the plane and the ocean's surface, there was no room to maneuver. A ground proximity warning began blaring, "Sink rate, pull up!" The cockpit was filled with constant noise.
"You're pitching up," the captain told the co-pilot. "Let's go," Bonin replied. "Pull up, pull up, pull up!"
The man stopped speaking for a moment.
"This can't be true," said Bonin.
The ocean was visible through the cockpit's windows. If the pilots had craned their necks, they could have made out individual waves.
"But what's happening?" Bonin asked.
2 seconds later, the plane plunged into the sea. 2. In the late 1980s, a group of psychologists at a consulting firm named Klein Associates began exploring why some people seem to stay calm and focused amid chaotic environments while others become overwhelmed. Klein Associates' business was helping companies analyze how they make decisions. A variety of clients wanted to know why some employees made such good choices amid stress and time pressures, while other workers became distracted. More important, they wanted to know if they could train people to get better at paying attention to the right things. The Klein Associates team began by interviewing professionals who worked in extreme settings, such as firefighters, military commanders, and emergency rescue personnel. Many of those conversations, however, proved frustrating. Firefighters could look at a burning staircase and sense if it would hold their weight. They knew which parts of a building needed constant attention and how to stay attuned to warning signs, but they struggled to explain how they did it. Soldiers could tell you which parts of a battlefield were more likely to be harboring enemies and where to focus for signs of ambush. But when asked to explain their decisions, they chalked it up to intuition. So the team moved on to other settings. One researcher, Beth Crandall, visited neonatal intensive care units, or NICUs, around Dayton, where she lived. A NICU, like all critical care settings, is a mix of chaos and banality set against a backdrop of constantly beeping machines and chiming warnings. Many of the babies inside a NICU are on their way to full health. They might have arrived prematurely or suffered minor injuries during birth, but they are not seriously ill. Others, though, are unwell and need constant monitoring. What makes things particularly hard for NICU nurses, however, is that it is not always clear which babies are sick and which are healthy. Seemingly okay preemies can become unwell quickly. Sick infants can recover unexpectedly. So nurses are constantly making choices about where to focus their attention: the squalling baby or the quiet one. The new lab results, or the worried parents who say something seems wrong. What's more, these choices occur amid a constant stream of data from machines, heart monitors and automatic thermometers, blood pressure systems and pulse oximeters, that are ready to sound alarms the moment anything changes. Such innovations have made patients safer and have remarkably improved NICU's productivity, because fewer nurses are now needed to oversee greater numbers of children. But they have also made NICUs more complex. Crandall wanted to understand how nurses made decisions about which babies needed their attention and why some of them were better at focusing on what mattered most. Crandall interviewed nurses who were calm in the face of emergencies and others who seemed on the brink of collapse. Most interesting were the handful of nurses who seemed particularly gifted at noticing when a baby was in trouble. They could predict an infant's decline or recovery based on small warning signs that almost everyone else overlooked. Often, the clues these nurses relied upon to spot problems were so subtle that they themselves had trouble later recalling what had prompted them to act. It was like they could see things no one else did, Crandall told me.
They seemed to think differently. One of Crandall's first interviews was with a talented nurse named Darlene, who described a shift from a few years earlier. Darlene had been walking past an incubator when she happened to glance at the baby inside. All of the machines hooked up to the child showed that her vitals were within normal ranges. There was another RN keeping watch over the baby, and she was observing the infant attentively, unconcerned by what she saw. But to Darlene, something seemed wrong. The baby's skin was slightly mottled instead of uniformly pink. The child's belly seemed a bit distended. Blood had recently been drawn from a pinprick in her heel, and the band-aid showed a blot of crimson rather than a small dot. None of that was particularly unusual or troubling. The nurse tending to the child said she was eating and sleeping well. Her heartbeat was strong. But something about all those small things occurring together caught Darlene's attention. She opened the incubator and examined the infant. The newborn was conscious and awake. She grimaced slightly at Darlene's touch, but didn't cry. There was nothing specific that she could point to, but this baby simply didn't look like Darlene expected her to. Darlene found the attending physician and said they needed to start the child on intravenous antibiotics. All they had to go on was Darlene's intuition, but the doctor, deferring to her judgment, ordered the medication and a series of tests. When the labs came back, they showed that the baby was in the early stages of sepsis, a potentially fatal whole-body inflammation caused by a severe infection. The condition was moving so fast that, had they waited any longer, the newborn would have likely died. Instead, she recovered fully. It fascinated me that Darlene and this other nurse had seen the same warning signs. They had all the same information, but only Darlene detected the problem, Crandall said. To the other nurse, the mottled skin and the bloody band-aid were data points, nothing big enough to trigger an alarm. But Darlene put everything together. She saw a whole picture. When Crandall asked Darlene to explain how she knew the baby was sick, Darlene said it was a hunch. As Crandall asked more questions, however, another explanation emerged. Darlene explained that she carried around a picture in her mind of what a healthy baby ought to look like, and the infant in the crib, when she glanced at her, hadn't matched that image. So the spotlight inside Darlene's head went to the child's skin, the blot of blood on her heel, and the distended belly. It focused on those unexpected details and triggered Darlene's sense of alarm. The other nurse, in contrast, didn't have a strong picture in her head of what she expected to see, and so her spotlight focused on the most obvious details. The baby was eating. Her heartbeat was strong. She wasn't crying. The other nurse was distracted by the information that was easiest to grasp. People like Darlene, who are particularly good at managing their attention, tend to share certain characteristics. One is a propensity to create pictures in their minds of what they expect to see. These people tell themselves stories about what's going on as it occurs. They narrate their own experiences within their heads. They are more likely to answer questions with anecdotes rather than simple responses. They say when they daydream, they're often imagining future conversations. They visualize their days with more specificity than the rest of us do. Psychologists have a phrase for this kind of habitual forecasting: creating mental models. Understanding how people build mental models has become one of the most important topics in cognitive psychology. All people rely on mental models to some degree. We all tell ourselves stories about how the world works, whether we realize we're doing it or not. But some of us build more robust models than others. We envision the conversations we're going to have with more specificity,
and imagine what we were going to do later that day in greater detail. As a result, we're better at choosing where to focus and what to ignore. The secret of people like Darlene is that they are in the habit of telling themselves stories all the time. They engage in constant forecasting. They daydream about the future, and then, when life clashes with their imagination, their attention gets snagged. That helps explain why Darlene noticed the sick baby. She was in the habit of imagining what the babies in her unit ought to look like. Then, when she glanced over and the bloody Band-Aid, distended belly, and mottled skin didn't match the image in her mind, the spotlight in her head swung toward the child's bassinet. Cognitive tunneling and reactive thinking occur when our mental spotlights go from dim to bright in a split second. But if we are constantly telling ourselves stories and creating mental pictures, that beam never fully powers down. It's always jumping around inside our heads. And, as a result, when it has to flare to life in the real world, we're not blinded by its glare. When the Air France Flight 447 investigators began parsing cockpit audio recordings, they found compelling evidence that none of the pilots had strong mental models during their flight. "What's this?" the co-pilot asked when the first stall warning sounded. "There's no good speed indication? We're in a climb?" Bonin responded. The pilots kept asking each other questions as the plane's crisis deepened because they didn't have mental models to help them process new information as it arrived. The more they learned, the more confused they became. This explains why Bonin was so prone to cognitive tunneling. He hadn't been telling himself a story as the plane flew along, and so when the unexpected occurred, he wasn't sure which details to pay attention to. "I have the impression we're going crazily fast," he said as the plane began to slow and fall. "What do you think?" And when Bonin did finally latch onto a mental model, "I'm in toga, right?" he didn't look for any facts that challenged that model. "I'm climbing, okay? So we're going down," he said 2 minutes before the plane crashed, seemingly oblivious to the contradiction of his words. "Okay, we're in toga," he added. "How come we're continuing to go right down?" "This can't be true," he said seconds before the plane hit the water. Then there are his last words, which make all the sense in the world once you realize Bonin was still grasping for useful mental models as the plane hurtled toward the waves. "But what's happening?" This problem isn't unique to the aviators of Flight 447, of course. It happens all the time, within offices and on freeways, as we're working on our smartphones and multitasking from the couch. "This mess of a situation is 100% our own fault," said Stephen Kastner, a research psychologist at NASA who has studied dozens of accidents like Air France Flight 447. "We started with a creative, flexible, problem-solving human and a mostly dumb computer that's good at rote, repetitive tasks like monitoring. So we let the dumb computer fly, and the novel-writing, scientific-theorizing, jet-flying humans sit in front of the computer like potted plants watching for blinking lights. It's always been difficult to learn how to focus. It's even harder now." A decade after Beth Crandall interviewed the NICU nurses, two economists and a sociologist from MIT decided to study how, exactly, the most productive people build mental models. To do that, they convinced a mid-sized recruiting firm to give them access to their profit and loss data, employees' appointment calendars, and the 125,000 email messages the firm's executives had sent over the previous 10 months. The first thing the researchers noticed as they began crawling through all that data was that the firm's most productive workers, its superstars, shared a number of traits. The first was they tended to work on only 5 projects at once. A healthy load, but not extraordinary. There were other employees who handled 10 or 12 projects at a time. But those employees had a lower profit rate than the superstars, who were more careful about how they invested their time. The economists figured the superstars were pickier because they were seeking out assignments that were similar to previous work they had done. Conventional wisdom holds that productivity rises when people do the same kind of tasks over and over. Repetition makes us faster and more efficient because we don't have to learn fresh skills with each new assignment. But as the economists looked more closely, they found the opposite. The superstars weren't choosing tasks that leveraged existing skills. Instead, they were signing up for projects that required them to seek out new colleagues and demanded new abilities. That's why the superstars worked on only 5 projects at a time. Meeting new people and learning new skills takes a lot of additional hours. Something else the superstars had in common is they were disproportionately drawn to assignments that were in their early stages. This was surprising, because joining a project in its infancy is risky. New ideas often fail, no matter how smart or well executed. The safest bet is signing on to a project that is well underway. However, the beginning of a project is also more information-rich. By joining fledgling initiatives, the superstars were CC'd on emails they wouldn't have otherwise seen. They learned which junior executives were smart and picked up new ideas from their younger colleagues. They were exposed to emerging markets and the lessons of the digital economy earlier than other executives. What's more, the superstars could later claim ownership of an innovation simply by being in the room when it was born, rather than fighting paternity battles once it was deemed a success. Finally, the superstars also shared a particular behavior, almost an intellectual and conversational tic. They loved to generate theories, lots and lots of theories about all kinds of topics, such as why certain accounts were succeeding or failing, or why some clients were happy or disgruntled, or how different management styles influenced various employees. They were somewhat obsessive, in fact, about trying to explain the world to themselves and their colleagues as they went about their days. The superstars were constantly telling stories about what they had seen and heard. They were, in other words, much more prone to generate mental models. They were more likely to throw out ideas during meetings or ask colleagues to help them imagine how future conversations might unfold or envision how a pitch should go. They came up with concepts for new products and practiced how they would sell them. They told anecdotes about past conversations and dreamed up far-fetched expansion plans. They were building mental models at a near constant rate. A lot of these people will come up with explanation after explanation about what they just saw, said Marshall Van Alstyne, one of the MIT researchers. They'll reconstruct a conversation right in front of you, analyzing it piece by piece. And then they'll ask you to challenge them on their take. They're constantly trying to figure out how information fits together. The MIT researchers eventually calculated that getting CC'd on those early information-rich emails and hashing out those mental models earned the superstars an extra $10,000 a year, on average, in bonuses. The superstars took on only 5 projects at once, but they outperformed their colleagues because they had more productive methods of thinking. Researchers have found similar results in dozens of other studies. People who know how to manage their attention and who habitually build robust mental models tend to earn more money and get better grades. Moreover, experiments show that anyone can learn to habitually construct mental models. By developing a habit of telling ourselves stories about what's going on around us, we learn to sharpen where our attention goes. These storytelling moments can be as small as trying to envision a coming meeting while driving to work, forcing yourself to imagine how the meeting will start, what points you will raise if the boss asks for comments, what objections your coworkers are likely to bring up. Or they can be as big as a nurse telling herself stories about what infants ought to look like as she walks through a NICU. If you want to make yourself more sensitive to the small details in your work, cultivate a habit of imagining, as specifically as possible, what you expect to see and do when you get to your desk. Then you'll be prone to notice the tiny ways in which real life deviates from the narrative inside your head. If you want to become better at listening to your children, tell yourself stories about what they said to you at dinner time last night. Narrate your life as you are living it, and you'll encode those experiences deeper in your brain. If you need to improve your focus and learn to avoid distractions, take a moment to visualize, with as much detail as possible, what you are about to do. It is easier to know what's ahead when there's a well-rounded script inside your head. Companies say such tactics are important in all kinds of settings, including if you're applying for a job or deciding whom to hire. The candidates who tell stories are the ones every firm wants. We look for people who describe their experiences as some kind of a narrative, Andy Billings, a vice president at the video game giant Electronic Arts, told me. It's a tip-off that someone has an instinct for connecting the dots and understanding how the world works at a deeper level. That's who everyone tries to get.